From WNYC, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone, reporting this week from Russia. An enemy turned friend turned... Well, our president has assured us that despite some recent nasty exchanges, Russia is not our enemy. And that's easy to see from the familiar shops, the bars, the aspirations humming and buzzing in the streets of Moscow. Our Russia story concerns free speech, where independent media are muffled and where the murder of muckrakers, such as Kremlin critic Anna Politkovskaya, are mostly ignored. We flew into a city awash in sunshine, music, money, and anxiety, at least for some. A lot's happened here since Yeltsin stood down a coup from atop a tank, since Russia's roaring 90s when the ruble was dying and the independent press was being born. On this perfect day in June, a rally in Pushkin Square. I ask a middle-aged woman, why are you here? She says, I'm here because I've run out of patience. Changing policies are taking us backwards. Our lives are going backwards. Former chess champion, current anti-Putin activist Garry Kasparov and his allies have staged a series of protests like this one in several cities this year. Despite an explicit policy of nonviolence, most have ended in bloody clashes with police. Not this one. Here, platoons of uniformed enforcers far outnumber the protesters, whose speeches are interrupted by pre-recorded heckling. Maniacal laughter blasted from a wall of speakers on a flatbed truck circling the square. The authorities seem to have overreacted to this demonstration because, by all accounts, Kasparov's calls for free elections and a freer press pose no real threat to public order or the popularity of President Putin.
Freedom of speech is not one of the basic commodities required by the people. They can skip it.
In the Yeltsin years, Yevgeny Kiselyov was Russian television's Walter Cronkite crossed with Ted Koppel. That is, until Kiselyov's boss, the oligarch who launched the hugely popular NTV channel, was prodded by President Putin into voluntary exile. The big pro-Kremlin oil company Gazprom bought NTV and chased all the independent journalists away, among them Kiselyov. Has the public ever really cared about freedom of the press?
Yes. In late 80s, because it was a new commodity that they've never tasted, something that they were longing for, and it was very sweet. I remember those famous queues to the newspaper kiosks that formed in the early hours of the morning in late 80s, started to subside by early 1991. Because the freedom of speech did not bring new prosperity, did not bring goods, did not stop inflation, and that's why they became very angry with the journalists. So you promised us everything and we've got nothing.
In fact, Kiselyov says he was surprised back in 91 to see Muscovites fill the streets to support Yeltsin's stand against the attempted communist coup. Then again, he says, it doesn't take that many to fill a street.
Majority of the Muscovites stayed home. Those who were conscientious supporters of democracy and freedom came out. Minority always matters, you know.
Do you see anyone on the horizon to help organize that now slumbering minority? Would it be Kasparov?
With all my due respect to Garry Kasparov, I don't think that he is capable of mobilizing the opposition and becoming its respected leader.
During the G8 summit earlier this month, Garry Kasparov gave a press conference in Moscow's House of Journalists. He had this to say about the powerful Western powers jawboning in Germany.
We want these leaders to state the obvious. Russia under Putin doesn't belong to G8 because it's not democracy and it's not an industrial power. Anytime they bring Putin to these big meetings, they treat him as an equal, they are extending these democratic credentials. And that works against us.
How do you contend with Mr. Putin's enormous popularity here?
I don't know anything about Mr. Putin's popularity.
Well, according to poll numbers.
Oh, yeah, and probably if U.S. administration could exercise the same control of the press in America, Bush would enjoy the same popularity. In the countries where democracy is in jeopardy, to talk about the popularity of the leader who was never contested in free and fair elections and was never faced a true debate with the opposition, I think it's totally irrelevant. You know, I believe that in Russia today, any poll that is related to a personal issue, whether it's Putin or a local mayor or a governor, always giving you a distorted picture. When you ask the same people about economy, about crime, about unemployment, healthcare, social conditions, they give you very different answers.
Kasparov may be Russia's most visible dissident in the West, but here he's neither seen nor heard outside Moscow and a few other major cities. He and many other opposition figures are banned from Russia's state-controlled TV networks, due largely to the 2002 law against extremism. It effectively stifles anyone or anything that could potentially destabilize the government by, say, criticizing it. Other rarely seen members of the opposition movement, known as Other Russia, include former Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov and Vladimir Ryzhkov, current member of Russia's lower legislative body, the Duma. Ryzhkov, once a prominent member, will soon be out of work because of another more recent law that sets almost impossibly high requirements for independent candidates seeking public office. Over coffee in a Kamergersky Periulik cafe, Ryzhkov says the law is crafted to keep Kremlin opponents out of power.
It's unbelievable. You know, 3 years ago we had 60 political parties. Today, because of this law and because of regulation, we have only 15. So that means that Russian laws specially created to stop citizens to participate in politics.
Do you find it disheartening that Putin is one of the most popular leaders in the world to his nation? Even more than the thicket of rules that Putin has set up, don't you have to deal with the fact that people still resent the time of Yeltsin for the chaos that ensued?
Yes, Putin is still very much popular. The question is why? First, as you said, is a contrast between him and Yeltsin. Of course, Yeltsin time, 90s, were awful time for Russians, and Yeltsin himself sometimes was ill, drunk, and strange. And of course, if compared with him, Putin is sportive, he is smart, he is energetic, so his image is much better. Second reason is that for last 7 years, there was no any program with criticism towards Putin. Can you imagine that in States? And third reason is that in petro states, leaders always are unpopular if oil prices and gas prices are very high. Look around Moscow, it's a luxury town, it's one of the richest towns in the world now. But objectively speaking, Russia is weak, and Russian economy is weak.
But as you say, perhaps as important as the Russia petrol dollars that are helping keep the country afloat, there's also the question of his image. He is not an embarrassing leader. You know, there's something about national pride.
You know, of course, after humiliation of 90s, when we lost Cold War, when we lost at least half of economy, of course, people need some pride on Russia, on our country. But question is, what quality of pride? Could we be proud because of murder of Politkovskaya and 6 months no any progress in investigation? Is it proudly for us? Could we be proud that the top 10 of Russians have incomes 25 times more than lowest 10% of population? Or could we be proud about Russian corruption, which is number one in the world, and last year it was about $300 billion? These topics are not discussed in Russian media. In Russian television, you can see only good news about Russia and only bad news about the West.
Let's talk about the state of the pro-democracy forces currently.
Putin saying and his administration saying, oh, who are these guys? Who are these guys in opposition? They're marginals. Who are the marginals? I'm asking Mr. Putin. The former chess champion is marginal, former prime minister, former central bank chairman, Mr. Gerashenko, or me, former first deputy chairman of Duma. We are marginals. You know, in Russia, to exist means to be in television. Me, Kasyanov, Kasparov, we never could appear on national TV. And because of that, opposition leaders are unpopular.
Putin maintains, and the people around Putin maintain, that Russia is a democracy.
No, Brezhnev said that Soviet Union was democracy too. Remember that. I think Putin cynically thinks that democracy does not exist anywhere. But everybody, Bush and Blair, saying that they are Democrats. Why don't Putin say that? Russians never lived in democracy, never in their history. Older generations remember Soviet time when state regulated everything, including private life. So now they feel themselves free because state does not touch their private lives. You can make your small business. You can travel to Tokyo resorts. You can buy any video. You can buy a Rolling Stones CD, which was restricted in Soviet time. And you can find jeans in any corner. And for many Russians, it's a democracy. So question is, are we still on transit from authoritarianism to democracy? Or transit is finished? And current authoritarian state, very traditional for Russia, is forever.
Ryzhkov finishes his coffee and heads back to the job, the one he'll lose because he won't be allowed to run in the upcoming March election. So much for his constituency in Siberia. Here in Moscow, Putin's media critics are permitted to carp within city limits.
Putin не настоящий президент, и, к сожалению,
and cheerful urbanites complain about their president between vodka shots. Coming up, one newspaper copes with the murder of its own, and the editor of Izvestia defends the Kremlin's view of freedom.
Hi there, this is Katia Rogers, senior producer of On the Media. We get lots of emails each week, but can only read a few on air, and sometimes none at all. But we love hearing what you think. And now you can leave comments for us on our website. Tell us what you think of a segment, respond to other comments, and ask questions. Just go to onthemedia.org and click on the comment icon below each segment.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone, reporting this week from Russia. Whenever reporters land in foreign capitals, they interview the cab driver. Ours conveniently held the same views as the vast majority of Russians, according to recent polls. Here's what Alexei says.
What do you think of President Putin?
He is a good president. He's done a lot in Russia. Have you seen the program when Putin answered the people's questions on television? He immediately made a decision, and with a single call, he fixed everything.
And it's not a problem that he doesn't really want a free press.
Why? We do have a free press. Everybody says whatever. Here there is no such thing as not being able to say something.
He doesn't want the opposition on the radio or television. Do you think that that's a good thing?
What do you mean by saying not letting the opposition on? We have everything on TV, everything that's possible. And what's forbidden is forbidden.
What do you think of Garry Kasparov?
You mean the chess player? I think Karpov is better.
Moscow may shelter a nest of elitist malcontents, but Alexei speaks for the general public.
Well, what can I do about the public? I don't have other public.
Yevgeny Kiselyov, big-time anchor under Yeltsin, turned smaller-time radio host under Putin.
The policy of glasnost started, it has a date. It started in late January 1987. There was a plenum of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union that officially allowed glasnost and abolished censorship, political censorship. Let's say we have 20 years of democratic media history in this country. So what do you expect?
He says journalists have to sell more than their work. They have to sell the idea that their work matters.
We have to face and accept it, that this is the public that we have. We have to stir them up somehow, and if we can, well, it's us to blame, nobody else.
But journalists might be forgiven for laying some of the blame at Putin's door. Boris Yeltsin, for all his fecklessness, did communicate a genuine regard for independent media. Putin conveys contempt. Russian broadcast personality Vladimir Posner was an unofficial Soviet spokesman during the Cold War as a frequent guest on Nightline. After Glasnost, he briefly co-hosted a show with Phil Donahue.
The way the media is treated here, I think, is very cynical. And basically, it's that if your newspaper, magazine, whatever, reaches a small number of people and you don't really influence public opinion at all, then you're pretty free to write what you want, and the same applies to radio or to a local television station. But as soon as your outlet reaches a lot of people, especially the so-called federal channels, which is the equivalent of network television in the United States, you only get that information which the powers that be want you to get.
Tell me how you want to be identified.
It's a good question. My name is Anastasia Izumskaya, and that's it, unemployed journalist.
Her former employer is Russia News Service, which produces newscasts and some news shows syndicated to hundreds of radio stations. Recently, the big oil company Lukoil became RNS's majority shareholder. Soon after that, the new management called for half of its news stories to be positive to boost ratings.
They told us that our listeners are successful people who own four shops and are about to buy a fifth, and they do not want to listen to tragic news. They need more positive news. They're interested in news about neckties and cufflinks, fashion trends.
And the new management suggested that eliminating voices from opposition parties not approved by the Kremlin would also be a very positive move. Izumskaya quit. Serious journalists across all media have quit or been fired or arrested or evicted or killed. Let's start with evicted, because in a sense, they're all being evicted. The Russian Union of Journalists, with more than 100,000 members throughout Russia, is getting kicked out of its building.
The thing is that the people who spread all kinds of gossip of what is going on here, they mainly don't care to check their information. They claim that I had wild animals here, but they are all tamed.
The head of the union, Igor Yakovenko, says the building was constructed back in 1980 with funds provided by journalists and that Yeltsin essentially gave it to them. The authorities claim the union is violating the Russian tax code by making improper commercial use of donated space. There's also been some grumbling about the menagerie in Yakovenko's office, the raccoon, the mongoose, the fox, the bunny, a couple of mammals we could neither identify nor translate, and the skunk.
Oh, my God.
Yakovenko says he's going to fight the eviction with all the legal muscle he can muster before the government has a chance to fill part of the building with a TV show called Russia Today. He says it's blatant propaganda. And then he observes, like all the other disgruntled reporters we spoke to, that propaganda and entertainment is all TV offers here. Russian TV journalists may feel a little confined, I said, but at least they don't suffer untimely evictions, do they?
This is true. People are better able to tolerate cages. They get used to them more quickly than animals. Animals are more freedom-loving, less ready to endure captivity. It's true. Maybe that's why I love animals so much.
A couple of flights down, the Center for Journalism in Extreme Situations, started 7 years ago by journalist and historian Oleg Panfilov.
We invented this name because we wanted to help journalists who are planning to work in Chechnya or other wars. But very soon we realized that all Russian journalists are in extreme situations.
Russia is the most dangerous place in the world to be a reporter after Iraq. 13 journalists have been murdered in contract-style killings since Putin took office. No one I spoke to would seriously accuse Putin of these murders, but no one has been brought to justice for these crimes, so he is charged with criminal indifference. When Anna Politkovskaya died, Putin told the German newspaper that despite her fame in the West, she was, quote, a person of little influence in Russia. Panfilov remembers the day she was buried on the outskirts of the city, far from public transportation.
It was raining. If you could only see how those hundreds of people walked in the rain, many kilometers, only to say goodbye to Anya.
But was she seen as a victim or a martyr? He said he saw her as both.
Victim because she was killed cruelly, and the martyr because she managed to prove that they were afraid of her. It means that what she was doing was right, and what she was doing was very important.
Politkovskaya worked at Novaya Gazeta, the third reporter at that paper killed under suspicious circumstances related to their work since Putin took office. Igor Domnikov was killed by a fatal blow to the head in 2000. Yuri Shikashikin died of a supposed allergy in 2003. The authorities wouldn't release his medical records, not even to his family, declaring them a medical secret. Novaya Gazeta deputy editor Sergei Sokolov is investigating all their deaths. He has suspects, but he doesn't really believe those responsible will ever be brought to justice. He looks exhausted. Why go on?
We need the truth not for the court or the prosecutor's office. We need it for ourselves and for the people who loved us and whom we love. Given the general state of modern journalism, I can say only one thing. What is the difference between our official journalists and prostitutes? The women who sell themselves in the streets know who they are and admit it. Journalists also know who they are, but they deny it and call themselves the free press.
If he could change anything about Russia, I asked him, what would it be? The courts, he said. Justice is served only to those with money or power. Andrei Richter is the director of the Moscow Media Law and Policy Center.
It's almost everywhere in this country that you can hire someone to kill your bad husband or bad wife, and people view it almost like street crime, like something which can happen every day. So when we speak about the murder of journalists, we should put it into this wider context.
You're making, you know, Russia, a land of laws, sound like some banana republic.
It is like a South American banana republic with only condition we don't have bananas, we have oil. But all the rest is about the same.
Russia has a range of legal remedies to settle a dyspeptic press. To oust the Union of Journalists, it's using alleged tax code violations. In a more notorious case, a U.S.-funded NGO that provides training to journalists here, called the Educated Media Foundation, or formerly Internews, was recently closed down. The reason? The director passed through Russian customs last January with a couple of $1,000s in cash she should have declared. She called it a stupid oversight. The Russian authorities responded by seizing the group's computers and freezing its funds, effectively closing it down. But there are other laws specifically designed to chill the media, especially one passed in 2002 called the Law Against Extremism. Andrei Richter.
So the law on extremism makes for the government possible to shut down media organizations if the government, the courts, the prosecutor's office believe that they disseminate political extremism materials. Political extremism materials more and more become an euphemism for political opposition materials.
I always say that freedom of speech is like a corridor.
Again, Vladimir Posner.
It can be a wide one, a narrow one, but there are walls. And if you try to break down those walls, you're going to have a problem. In this case, in Russia today, it's much narrower. It's not censorship in the classic sense of the word. It's to say you don't go to a censor who reads your piece and then puts a stamp on it the way it was in the Soviet Union. But clearly, there are people and subjects that at this time you cannot touch.
Smaller outlets like Novaya Gazeta or the maverick radio station Echo Moskvy, we'll get to that in a minute, don't much worry the Kremlin, but no media outlet of real influence and reach, especially TV, can touch
the unofficial opposition. In Putin's managed democracy, there is an official opposition, members of which hold seats in the Duma and even appear fleetingly on TV. But unofficials, like Garry Kasparov, are designated extremist. Posner says he'd like to invite Kasparov on his popular national TV show, but he can't. He can, however, invite the ultra-nationalist newspaper editor Alexander Prokhanov, who was regarded as extremist under Yeltsin. Prokhanov recently called for Russians not to send their biological material abroad, not even for medical tests, because Russia's enemies could use it to create a biological weapon. I had a brief talk with Prokhanov about press freedom. I believe I heard you say just now that you were a Stalinist and you felt that the Soviet period was the best period for Russia.
You are not mistaken.
I am here, I'm an American journalist here to report on the state of freedom of speech in Russia today. What do you have to say to somebody like me?
In the Soviet period, I felt I was totally free. KGB did not follow me. I was a very successful writer. After the Soviet Union collapsed and the era of real freedom started, when freedom of speech occurred, when liberals came to power, and when press was called the Fourth Estate, we lost our freedom of speech. Great writers and journalists who were very close to me were deprived of their right to appear on TV screens. We felt like we lived under a plastic cap. Now the situation has begun to change. In the Putin era, liberals who once had great access to the media are being pushed into the background, and people of my views, who believe in a strong Russian state and centralized control over the economy and culture, have more and more opportunities. My new newspaper, which I started after my old paper Day was shut down, is called Tomorrow. It has no difficulties, either legal or financial. All the TV channels constantly invite me, the Stalinist and Russian state supporter. So how can I claim after all that in Putin's Russia there is no freedom of speech?
You are a welcome guest on the first channel. Does it bother you that, for instance, Garry Kasparov is not?
No, it does not bother me. Because there was a time when Garry Kasparov was a welcome visitor at all the channels, and my absence did not bother him. It doesn't even bother me that during the dissenters' march, the police clubbed Garry Kasparov's allies. It doesn't bother me at all, because at other times my friends were beaten nearly to death during our rallies. They shot at us from tanks and machine guns, and people like Garry Kasparov never bothered to stand up for us.
Is this then a matter of more speech now, or simply different speech?
Of course it's a different freedom of speech. Russia is a country where freedom of speech first belongs to some, and they shut the others' mouths, and then freedom of speech passes to the others, and the first ones have to keep their mouths shut. Such is the Russian peculiarity.
Radio Echo Moskvy. Prokhanov appears once a week on Echo Moskvy, a radio station he admires even though he says it's his ideological enemy. One of the most popular stations in Moscow, Echo Moskvy slams Putin with stunning regularity, breaking the law on extremism practically on the hour. It's a puzzle no Russian media watcher can solve. How can it do what it does, owned as it is by the solidly pro-Kremlin Gazprom, the oil company that broke the back of the once freewheeling NTV channel, the very emblem of vibrant Yeltsin-era media? Now with NTV firmly under the thumb of the Kremlin, its old journalists are running for cover at, you guessed it, Echo Moskvy. Why is it still on the air? Few even venture a guess, except Echo Moskvy talk show host Yevgeny Kiselyov.
The biggest reason is that in the eyes of the Kremlin, we are not a leverage of political influence. That's number one. Number two, we do not represent any kind of major threat to what is now euphemistically called stability. Number three, they can always shut us down. And they know that. And number four, they need a showcase. They need a window decoration, so to say. When you American guys come here, your politicians, your public figures come here to start talking about, well, violations of the freedom of the speech, they say, well, wait. We have Echo Moskvy. and they are allowed to criticize everyone, to ask most difficult questions, and all the opposition figures are there day and night. So what are you talking about?
Journalists tend to be a cynical lot, none more so than Russian journalists. Still, some place a measure of hope on the next election, even if it is Putin's hand-picked successor, because things change in Russia, and it could go either way. Even now, alternative voices get through. A new independent political magazine has emerged called New Times. The internet is developing. A TV channel based in New York with bureaus in Germany, Israel, and Moscow has some limited reach in Russia. It's called RTVI, paid for in part by the same oligarch who created NTV. Recently, one of its anchors, Andrei Norkin, who also works at Echo Moskvy, won Russian Broadcasting's award for Best News Presenter for a program few can even watch. It was a protest of sorts from within the ranks. I asked Kiselyov if he thinks he'll ever get out of his gilded cage at Echo Moskvy.
I'm quite sure of that, because sooner or later, the situation in the country will change. It cannot last forever. Of course, we don't know who are the next leaders. And probably in 4 years from now or in 8 years from now, we'll be nostalgically reminiscing about the gold days of Vladimir Putin's liberal presidentship.
Nostalgia of all sorts is a frequent theme here. Even nostalgia for the good old, bad old days of fighting to be heard. Actually, that may be, in Prokhanov's phrase, the real Russian peculiarity. More on that in Words and Music coming up. This is NPR's On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, online at matfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media, reporting this week from Russia. When you're representing an American radio program called On the Media, and you say you want to talk about free speech, pro-Kremlin media heavyweights will cross the street to avoid you. Aside from Alexander Prokhanov, who in the last segment laid out an extreme position even by Russian standards today, we couldn't find anyone of importance, by which I mean a player, willing to sit down with us and explain the Kremlin's position. Except one. Vladimir Mamontov, editor-in-chief of one of the nation's most important, most famous, most emblematic newspapers, Izvestia. Izvestia started out as a revolutionary paper in 1917, but soon became an organ of the government. It was Stalinist under Stalin, and then it grew more liberal during the thaw of Nikita Khrushchev. In the late 80s and into the 90s, it was in the forefront of perestroika. And in 2005, it was purchased, as was so much of Russian media, by the state-owned oil company Gazprom. Its liberal editor was sent packing to be replaced by former Komsomolskaya Pravda deputy editor Vladimir Mamontov. Liberals have bemoaned what they see as the paper's devolution into a Kremlin mouthpiece. Mamontov, obviously, sees it differently.
Nowadays, as editor-in-chief of Izvestia, I want to see it as a definitely conservative, definitely pro-government newspaper, and there is no desire on my part to conceal that. It seems to me that it is within the boundaries of the freedom of speech to follow this line, and I think those people who inform you that there is something wrong with Izvestia are, in fact, exactly the people who want to monopolize the very notion of freedom of speech and who do not want to tolerate any opinion different from their own. So they are eager to label other heterodox newspapers as Yellow Press or pro-Putin or KGB-dependent publications. These shallow allegations, I hear them every day.
My question is how you make your decisions, what red lines you have at your paper. In other words, we know what's happened to television under Gazprom. Gazprom is becoming a media empire which is very closely associated with Putin. If there isn't any explicit censorship, the feeling is that there is probably some self-censorship.
The thing is that I have my own independent political views formed throughout my life. and in order to live by them, express them, or use them as the guidelines in my editorial policy, I do not need either Gazprom or Putin. It has been my understanding for a long period of time that Russia should be strong, should use its advantages, and so on.
But I wonder, as a journalist, what do you think of Putin's policies regarding a free press in Russia?
I think that during the Yeltsin years, the press was handled mostly by oligarchs like Berezovsky and Kuczynski, and they managed Russian media outlets in the way that it would suit them. It was not until Putin became the president that this way of thinking was interrupted. Instead, there have been created official TV networks, which, as is practiced in many countries in the world, hold a very well-balanced, cautious, and absolutely pro-government position. There are lots of presidents like this all over the world. The difference is only in the mastery of disguise. And our networks might be too straightforward, not sophisticated enough. At the same time, you can't underestimate the role of these TV stations in stabilizing situation in society. Undoubtedly, they do that using a range of methods, like filtering of information, entertainment programming. All in all, it would be really strange to deny that, to a certain extent, our TV networks function in propaganda mode. At the same time, I should tell you that having traveled a lot through many countries, I do not remember a single case when the major TV station would be in opposition to the government.
Is it because you feel Russia is so fragile that it can't handle opposition on mainstream television?
As soon as we establish a secure and predictable multi- or bipartisan system, and after we have lived with it for several years, I will totally agree with you and would root for all kinds of opposition. I would not be concerned with the fragility of Russia anymore. You have asked me if I consider the economical, political, or any other part of Russian life to be unstable. I'd say I do not understand how I can live without this fear of instability if I have lived the major part of my life being the communist, then found myself in the midst of perestroika, then lived through the tumultuous 1990s. How can I be sure that the situation in Russia will be stable from now on without me personally contributing to this stabilization? I saw how easily things break apart and replace one another. Those irreversible changes happen not always based on the needs or agreement of the majority. Not at all. There were lots of outside factors, political forces. I saw all this happen with my own eyes, saw how political methods work. I still witness similar scenarios played out.
Do you think, given this point in Russia's history, it's all right for the president or the government to control the principal means by which people get information in this country, television?
Can you show me any country where the sources of mass information are not controlled? Same things happen all over the world. The political force in power manages the way information is distributed. I do not want to expose my colleagues from Western media who are quite frank with me in describing how it all works in states. Who is calling from where, how the problems are taken care of, how the interaction with the government is structured. The only way out of this situation is to have different journalist publications and media outlets coming from the opposing political parties. So just give us the time and we'll create those opposing forces, normal political parties. You do not have those extremists that we do, apart from the so-called political party of anti-globalists that break the windows. We have our freaks, you have yours. I am very sure that all these mechanisms will emerge and develop in Russia. And by the way, it will happen much faster with your assistance. It would be, in fact, nice to receive some encouragement instead of the streams of criticism that serve as a better evidence of Western journalists' ignorance and inability to comprehend the situation in Russia than of anything else.
But do you sympathize at all with the concern that this control of Russian television smacks of the past, of the Cold War? You say that you are an ex-communist, but that said, would you wouldn't want to go back to that time. Do you see why people might be worried about that?
I can assure you that
not a single sensible individual in Russia wants to get back to USSR. I do not see any serious signs of totalitarian regime here. Totalitarianism is very serious and has nothing to do with what's happening. Our citizens are free to go wherever they want, film what they want, stage their plays on any subject they want. Our cinemas show their motion pictures all over the world. Anything can get published. Internet is not banned or blocked. You ask me if I want to go back. Well, being a person with keen interest for Western music, Western literature, I do not want to go back. Instead, I want to integrate my new interests with my love for Russian literature and many facets of Soviet life as well. By the way, there are absolutely anti-Putin plays that are on in the theaters all over the country.
Only not on TV.
That's separate.
But you can't integrate culture without politics. Politics can never be left aside.
Just pay attention to this curious phenomenon for a moment. Among all the imaginable freedoms our people have, mobility, right to work, and all the freedoms that I talked about a couple of minutes before, you somehow concentrate only on those freedoms that have their shortcomings, that are in some ways limited. Why do you not blame EU for not giving Russian citizens open-date visas? This way, our people could travel more and consequently learn from the Western democratic experience. Let's focus on this problem as well. I just see that you have a tendency to select a certain point and devote all of your attention to it. And I can detect a certain bias in this approach.
So true, but our program is called On the Media. However, one could easily extrapolate that from freedom of speech, freedom of the press, emerges all freedoms, ultimately freedom of thought.
I am sometimes smitten by your Western self-confidence. You are somehow sure that everything you say, all the values you propagate, be they true or false, are ultimately good and indispensable for everybody. But, my dear friends, it's so much not right. I'll reiterate, it's not true. There are different civilizations who created their own values, and Russia is one of them. You can't point to us which freedom is more important and to which extent it has to be presented. We might as well figure it out ourselves. We do not ever try to dictate to you the rules of the game. This problem is actually at the root of everything else. Gentlemen, just let us have our own values. Do not put this mercy on us by force, as you do in Iraq, in Serbia. Whenever the due progress is not achieved, you use your military force, bombs, air force. Why don't you start with yourself and deal with your own bush? Everybody says Russian journalists are in danger, but look at what's happening in Iraq. How many journalists and people were killed there? Thousands of people have been murdered. Why were those people killed? What did they suffer for? In fact, they suffered for democratization, according to the rules you consider to be superior and true. Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Vladimir Mamontov is the editor of Izvestia, a former communist with no nostalgia, he says, for the days of iron control of the culture. But with the shifting perspectives that convulse Russia on a regular basis, nostalgia is very much on people's minds. For many Russians, the dark days were also the golden days of youth, of long nights over a bottle with friends, and the bittersweet struggle for self-expression.
Небо этого дня ясное.
Those days are preserved as in amber in the music of the Russian bards, like Vladimir Vysotsky, who sang about the longings and frustrations of the 60s generation, now nostalgic for the days when they had something to fight against.
Some people, they have their own nostalgia for the pioneer camps, can you imagine?
Natalia Ivanova is the editor of the literary magazine Znamia, once an important journal of art and ideas, where elliptical language conveyed subversive messages.
Our magazine, in the beginning of the perestroika, we have 1 million copies. Now we have 4,500. But there's no nostalgia for that very time. For me, better it would be the society free and we not so important, just having only art for art.
As for the new generation of bards, they're popular, drawing hundreds of thousands to an annual festival. And while the best of them credit the great old bards, Vysotsky, Berlat Atkujava, and Alexander Galich as inspirations, now they have a different role. Timur Shal is one of the best of the new breed.
он пел нам битлов, мол, all you need is love. Какая love, чувак, сейчас all you need is money.
I sat down with Shalv in his Moscow flat and began at the beginning. What do you write about?
About life. Когда меня спрашивают, где вы берете темы,
about life. When people ask me where I get material for my songs, I always say the material is all around me. It's walking in the streets, driving around in Mercedes, begging in subways. For me to write a song, I need to be in a light, cheerful, but annoyed mood. When I see our Duma voting, I can respond with a song. Material is in the air. For instance, one of my songs is devoted to Delta Airlines. They lost my luggage, and so I wrote a song. I still haven't got my luggage back. No one believes me. My American friends say they should have at least paid me. Anyway, I never got any money from them. So I wrote a song about how they stole my baggage.
In the old bard tradition, the songs are almost uniformly sad. It sounds like in the new bard tradition, the songs are ironic, upbeat, funny.
Young people today are different. They don't ruminate so much. I do not know whether it's good or bad, but they're playing happy songs, and I think that's good.
How are the times different now? I mean, what characterizes these times?
Мне кажется, конечно,
it seems to me that back in Stalin's day, people would say that life is better, life is merrier, but that was tongue-in-cheek. But I've always been an optimist. It seems to me that the life today is much better, but we must still be on our guard so that we don't sleep through it. I mean, what characterizes our time is that there are no shake-ups, no revolutions. It's not like it used to be when every day you would wake up and people would say, hey guys, this morning it's a whole new country. Now things are different. You seem to wake up in the same country, but everything moves quietly, quietly, and when you wake up, it seems as if things are not going quite the way you really want it. So this is very dangerous. But apart from that, these are good times.
You said that you write about how the times are changing. What's the starkest change that you see?
I suppose, after all, it is freedom of speech. Everything else begins with it, it seems to me. Everything else is based on that. Economy, law, etc. Every sphere is dominated by whether there is freedom of speech or there isn't freedom of speech. If we lose it now, there won't be any economic success, and we'll go back to how it was. I'm convinced that we will. And I do not want my country to become a regime like one determined by the drilling of its oil, like some despotic Asian or African country. I really don't want that.
Азиатско-африканским режимом. Мне очень не хочется.
The original bard tradition reminds me a little of the American tradition of the protest song that emerged in the early 60s. And along with it came this idealistic belief that you could change the world with your music. Does anybody hold that belief here now?
We shall overcome, да? Я вообще циник.
Well, I'm a cynic. I'm pragmatic. The role these songs play in our country today is, thank God, a more aesthetic than a political role. Maybe, God forbid, the time will come again when it will have to play a political role. But nevertheless, they won't show me on television. Even when I sang in a festival on Moscow Echo that was recorded for TV, they showed the whole thing except for my song. I'm not going to claim there was pressure on freedom of speech. You know, maybe they had artistic reasons to cut me out. Maybe they didn't like my vocals or the way I play guitar. But you can see a trend towards self-preservation, you know. People who try to be holier than the Pope. And they will cut out totally innocent things. So I don't have any illusions. I'm not for television. Well, it's all right. My CDs are passed around. People share the CDs just like in the old times, just like Vysotsky records were passed around. And as for the role of the bard song today, it doesn't aim to overturn the world. But if it must, we'll be singing something else.
Надо будет, значит, будем петь что-то другое.
What song didn't people get to watch on state television?
Песня называлась «Выбери меня». Я как бы в ней...
The song was called «Elect Me». I decided, as a joke, to run for president. At the concerts, I usually say, Putin is leaving, and since there's no one to replace him, I decided to run. And I will sing you my election program in the song. It's quite an innocent song, though I understand what might have frightened them about.
Конечно, я понимаю, что их могло в ней испугать.
If elected, will you serve?
Я очень надеюсь, что не выберут.
I really hope they don't elect me. God forbid. Better I should go back to being a doctor.
Медицину, да.
I'll vote for you.
Спасибо. Thank you.
Все в стране ужасно. Все
That's it for this week's show from Russia. For more information, check out our website at onthemedia.org.
Бисмарка там нету, нет Шатобриана, значит, надо, чтобы главным выбрали меня. И сразу наших олигархов разведу я круто.
On the Media is supported by the Beidel Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbooked Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Hooray! Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers' Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.